Good evening and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and tonight I'm hosting Dames in the Dark. I have an exciting lineup of crime writers that will be sharing their work on tonight's show. We'll be hearing from Sean Riley Simmons, Lindy Walker, Sandra Rattan, Jen Mikulski, and Marietta Miles. Noir on the Radio is a trademark, copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Network, LLC. If you'd like to talk to any of our guests tonight, just dial 347-633-9609 at any time during the live show, and I'll get you on ASAP. That number again is 347-633-9609. And I might have a little bit of Greg Barth news I'll share later on as well if we have time. To start things off tonight, Sean Riley Simmons will share a selection from her writing. And Sean Riley Simmons is the author of The Red Carpet Catering Mysteries, featuring Penelope Sutherland, an on-set movie caterer, and of the short story, A Gathering of Great Detectives, appearing in Malice Domestic 11, Murder Most Conventional. Sean was born in Indiana, grew up in Florida, and began a professional career in New York City as a sales executive after graduating from the University of Maryland with a BA in English. Since then, she's worked as a bookstore manager, fiction editor, mystery convention organizer, wine consultant, and caterer. She's been on the board of directors of Malice Domestic since 2003, is a founding member of the Dames of Detection, and an editor at Level Best Books, publishers of the best New England crime stories anthologies. Cooking behind the scenes on movie sets perfectly combined two of her great loves, movies and food, and provides inspiration for the Red Carpet Catering series. The third Red Carpet Catering mystery, Murder on a Designer Diet, was released in June. The fourth, Murder is the Main Course, will be released in March of 2017. She also has short stories appearing in three upcoming anthologies: Windward, the 14th annual Best New England Crime Stories, which is due out this November; Busted, Arresting Stories from the Beat; and Malice Domestic 12, Mystery Most Historical, both of which will be published in the spring of 2017. So, Sean Riley Simmons, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to have you on tonight.
Thanks. I'm very thrilled to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Great, great. So, what are you reading for us tonight?
This is a complete departure from the Red Carpet Catering stories. This is a newly conceived slash fiction piece, kind of more in a noir vein, to send a tribute to my fellow ladies tonight.
Excellent. Should we expect food or wine in this one, or maybe not so much?
No, not so much. Maybe afterwards.
Not so much.
Definitely afterwards.
Okay. Well, excellent. Please, take it away.
Okay. This is a short story entitled Assembler Rigged. Where's the ball? Ramon growled, wiping a sheen of sweat from his upper lip. Under that one, Brad said, darting his eyes to the wooden cup in the center. He twisted his arms against the ropes that secured him to the chair. Wrong, Ramon said with a chuckle, flipping it over to reveal nothing but the greasy tablecloth underneath. Wait, I was sure it was that one, Brad said. Give me another chance. Ramon sucked his teeth and lifted the cup on the left, revealing the scarred wooden ball. He put it back on the table and slid the cups over the tablecloth again. Which one now? Ramon said. He pulled the gun from his waistband and placed it on the table. I have an idea, Brad said, fresh panic in his voice. Why don't you give me 3 out of 5 guesses? Ramon rolled a toothpick into the corner of his mouth. Why should I do this? Encouraged, Brad spoke rapidly. Because, you know, fairness and all. You think it's fair to sleep with another man's wife? Ramon said, his brow darkening. He laid his hand on the gun and rubbed the silver barrel with his index finger. In all fairness, I didn't know she was anyone's wife, Brad said, slipping into his best salesman's smile. I thought she was just the maid coming to clean my room. Still, Ramon said, considering, you might have reasoned she was someone's wife, seeing as she wears a ring. Brad laughed a little too loudly. Right, right, Ramon. You got me there. I should have asked about that before you slept with her, Ramon said, chewing on his toothpick. Look, Ramon, man to man. Sophia didn't tell me she was married, and we've had fun. It's not like I've been forcing her into bed all weekend. That should count for something, right? Ramon gazed at him, a faint smile playing at his lip. Actually, it's more her fault than mine, Brad reasoned, when you think about it. Ramon's smile disappeared and he sat forward. Say that again and see how things go for you, tourist. Color drained from Brad's face and he jerked against the ropes, the legs of his chair lifting off the floor. Is this really the punishment for accidentally having an affair down here? Yeah, it is, Ramon said. He picked up the gun and pointed it at Brad's forehead. Choose correctly, and I'll only break your arm. Pick the wrong one again, and poof, no more smooth-talking salesman. Brad looked around the dingy basement. Why are you doing this? Why didn't you just shoot me in my room? Too messy. Good-paying customers are checking in tomorrow. Plus, it doesn't work that way, Ramon said, placing the gun back on the table. But why this? Brad asked, motioning with his eyes at the cuffs. A mouse scurried along the wall, and Brad lifted his leather loafers off the floor. Ramon threw his head back and laughed, revealing gold-plated molars. You know how many rich businessmen come down here and think they can do whatever they want just because they're in another country on vacation? It's not so hard to believe when one of you goes missing. Guests wander off, get conned by street hustlers, whores, end up paying the price. I still don't get it. We're not really gambling if I lose either way. You want me to shoot you right now? Ramon asked. No, I just don't understand what we're doing, Brad said. You ask a lot of questions, Ramon said, crossing his arms tightly at his chest. This is how I like to do it. Do what? Shut up and choose a cup, Ramon said, failing to hide his irritation. Shuffle them again, Brad said. We've been talking too long. Ramon blew out a long sigh and slid the cups around. Pick one, tourist. Brad cleared his throat. That one, he said, and darted his eyes to the right. Ramon upended the cup and revealed the ball, rolling slightly back and forth on the tablecloth. Brad's eyes grew wide. I found it. Good job, salesman, Ramon said. Too bad I only get to break your arm. Wait, Brad said. He scraped the chair across the floor and jerked his shoulders from side to side, struggling to free him. Ramon jumped up and tipped him backwards, the wooden chair crashing against the concrete floor. Stop, Sophia shouted from the doorway. Her face was in shadow, the light from the hallway outlining her shapely figure beneath her cotton maid's uniform. Sophia, help, Brad shouted from beneath Ramon, who stood over him, grasping his wrist. Sophia went to the table and picked up the gun, raising it steadily at the men. Stop this, Ramon. Sit him up, she said in an even voice. Ramon stood up and pulled the chair upright with Brad still attached, setting it down on all fours with more force than was strictly necessary. He stood behind the chair, his hands laying heavily on Brad's shoulders. Sophia, thank God you found us. Let's get out of here, Brad said, relief flooding his face. Sophia aimed the gun at Ramon's head. Did he find the ball? Yes. After a few tries, Ramon said, he was very bad at guessing. I gave him extra chances. So it's my turn this time, Sophia said. She lowered her aim and pulled the trigger. Brad's eyes grew wide as he watched the blood spread across his dress shirt. Ramon, did you know that Brad is a top salesman for his company in all of the USA? Sophia said, a slight accent clipping through her words. A big shot, huh? Ramon asked. With just $200 in cash and a maxed out credit card, Sophia sniffed, pulling Brad's wallet from the pocket of her apron. Brad's eyes glazed over and he began to fade, his confusion morphing into understanding. And this, Sophia said, slipping open the worn leather wallet to reveal a picture of Brad standing next to a tall brunette in a wedding dress. She tossed the wallet onto the table and slipped the gun into her apron pocket. Time to get back to work, she said to Ramon, who followed her out the door, closed it behind them. The end.
Nice.
Very nice.
Thanks. You want to go on vacation with me?
So Sean, I understand you have a previous career as a caterer on movie sets, and with your series, the Red Carpet Catering Mysteries, I would imagine you draw pretty heavily on that experience.
Yeah, I did do that, and I, you know, dabbled here and there. My sister did it for a long time, and I would go and help her out whenever she needed an extra set of hands in the kitchen. So over the years, over about the 10-15-year period, I was popped in and out and would help out from here and there in different sets and stuff. And then eventually both got hired onto a team that I worked full-time on a movie for 3-4 months in the D.C. area, which was a really great experience. And being in the malice domestic world, you see a lot of different, you know, sort of, they call them traditional cozy sort of mysteries where there's a small town and everyone comes in and out, like the kind of a cozy type of thing, you know. And I thought, well, I've seen a lot of catering mysteries, seen a lot of, you know, bakery shop things, but I've never seen a behind-the-scenes movie series. I've never seen that really anywhere. And I had firsthand experience and knew exactly how it works. I thought this would be a good, unique setting, you know, that I didn't feel anyone else would be able to do, so that's why I chose to do that. But it's a very unique job. It's not everyone has ever, you know, a lot of people have been caterers, not so much, you know, theatrical caterers. It's a different animal. So, but yeah, it was a wonderful experience. I loved it. And it was super hard work and like 16-hour days sometimes, but out in the elements and in the cold, and you're making roast salmon for 300 people, but it was awesome. And I loved it.
Wow. Any favorite awesome. Sets or any favorite celebrities?
I have hooked for one of the James Bonds, actually the current James Bond, who might not be the current, he might be leaving, but I did work for, I did cook for Daniel Craig, I cooked for Nicole Kidman on the movie The Invasion. That was a really great experience. Jeremy Northam was on that set, and lots of other people, but it was a great set. And my sister has cooked for Robert De Niro, Harvey Keitel, Sylvester Stallone. And her husband is a Teamster, and he worked on Sex and the City, and so I got to pop onto that set once in a while and visit him. And he works on Law and Order SVU right now. So, and his father was a Teamster. He worked on Law and Order, the original Law and Order, like way back in the 90s, and we were all like in school still. His dad. So yeah, we have it's a long running show business sort of thing in our family. But yeah, it's fun. It's really cool. And I'm such a movie nerd. It's always fit in with my whole thing.
Well,
I am such
nice
a movie nerd that I actually keep spreadsheets on movies, and I make sure that I see like every movie that's nominated for different categories of awards, and I take it to the extreme nerd. I'm very nerdy.
Good for you. That's fun.
Yeah, it is. It's my own little. I don't share that with everyone, but I guess I just did. So.
Oh, yes.
That's
interesting. So where can people find you out there and keep up with you online?
I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. My website, SeanRileySimmons.com, has a list of upcoming events that I'm involved in. I'm pretty out there. You can find me.
And you have two more
installments. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
you have two more installments from the Red Carpet Catering Mysteries up and coming. And what else is new and up and coming for you?
I have a variety of short stories, and then I'm thinking of a new type of book for next year. I'm going to work on more of a thriller, more of a dark, maybe a standalone apart from my series. So just to sort of stretch my legs in that area. And that's it. And then apart from I go to Malice every year and I help run, which is a large convention, and it's a lot of work. So I work on that every year. And I'm also now going to be involved in Crime Bake because I'm one of the level best editors, so which is a mystery convention that takes place in the Boston area every November. So, but I'm all mystery all the time.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Do any of the other guests have any questions for Sean?
When are you going
to
come back?
All right, Sean, thank
up.
You so much for you. And next up, we have Lindy Walker. And Lindy Walker is the author of the national best-selling Headlines in High Heels mystery series, beginning with the Agatha Award-nominated Front Page Fatality. The newest book in the series, Lethal Lifestyles, will be published on September 27th. And before she started writing mysteries, Lindy was an award-winning journalist. Her work has appeared in newspapers and magazines across the U.S., She adores her family, her readers, and enchiladas. She often works out tricky plot points while walking off the enchiladas. She lives in Richmond, Virginia, where she's either playing with her children, working on her next novel, or admiring beautiful shoes that she can't wear. Lindy, welcome to Noir on the Radio. How are you tonight?
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun to be here tonight.
Well, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. So first, I like your name. You don't meet many Lindys out there. Where does that name come from?
Oh, there's an interesting story there. For generations in my family, it was kind of a thing to do the funky spelling with the random capital letter in the middle. Like my grandmother's name was Dolores, but it was spelled D-A-L-O-R-Y-S-E. And my mother spent her entire pregnancy determined that she was going to buck every tradition she possibly could, being a single mom in the 70s in the buckle of the Bible Belt in North Central Texas.
Wow.
And so she was going to name me Tiffany. And she had decided that and knew it until she went into labor. And the movie on the TV had a main character named Lindy that she really liked. And so she spent the entire time that she was in labor sitting with her sister coming up with a list of all the different ways you could spell it. And every time I ever complained about not being able to find my name printed on anything when I was growing up, she would tell me that if she had not been in labor for 36 hours, she would not have had time to get to this one. So it bothered me when I was a kid, but I like it now. It's different, you know. So,
well, it's unique. It's very, it stands out in a good way. So what are you reading for us tonight?
So I have a selection from Covershot, which is the fifth book in the Headlines and High Heels series. It's came out last November, and I really had a good time in this book with kind of taking a couple of big questions. How far would any of us go to save someone we loved from a terrible fate? And pulling some things from current headlines and kind of flipping them upside down. And in this scene, they have an active shooter who has shut down a hospital in downtown Richmond. And my main character is a reporter named Nichelle Clark, and she is on her way inside to talk to him. It was so quiet. I'm not sure what I expected, but dead, utter, you could hear a gnat sneeze silence was pretty far down my list. I've been through the doors at St. Vincent's a million times. The hospital has noise, music, loudspeakers, phones, people, bustle. Not today. The front desk was empty, and the lack of sweet old lady smiles from the candy stripers was more ominous than the stillness. Something was definitely wrong here. I pulled in a deep breath and uprooted my feet from the tile just inside the door, turning to nod at the SWAT captain who walked me in and wondering if I was really brave or just really stupid. Some days it's a toss-up. Squaring my shoulders, I strode to the elevators and jabbed the up button. Of course I was scared, but I'd dumped my shoe collection in a storm drain before I'd let on. The elevator crept upward, and I patted the vest, assuring myself that everything would work out just fine. I had a radio to Aaron in my bag and a mission: get myself and everyone else out of the building safely. I was good with people, and Aaron had SWAT on point at every door, ready to blast it in at my first gasp. It was fine. The bell for the fifth floor binged, and the doors whispered open, loud in the silence. Still no people. I walked past a nurse's station and peeked into a patient room. Rumpled bed, half-eaten dinner on the tray. No patient. I kept walking, the click-clack of my stilettos on the tile echoing off the walls like firecrackers. The squeak of a door froze my Louboutin in midair. I turned, a single eyeball peering at me through the barest of door opening. It widened, and the door slipped shut again. The sign marked it as a break room. Hoping the staff had jammed everyone in there, I kept on walking. No blood was a good sign. No gunfire was a better one. The ICU was at the end of the hallway. The sliding glass doors closed. It took 1,100 years for me to walk close enough for them to open. Who's there? A man's voice, high and stressed, and a rifle cocking. Shit. I cleared my throat. Nichelle Clark, Richmond Telegraph? Miss Clark? He sounded unsure. You're alone? The police said you wanted to talk to me. I took a teensy step forward. I wanted to see the guy. I didn't want to get shot, though. You ready to chat? Sneakers squeaked across the floor. I closed my hand around the mace canister Kyle had given me when I refused to take the handgun class. Squeak, squeak, squeak. Rifle lacked in his hands, the man who'd caused all the uproar appeared in the doorway. And I let out a huge whoosh of air and reached for a pen. 3 inches shorter than me, he was slight but muscular. Thinning brown hair, glasses, and jeans and a t-shirt that had been slept in more than once. And his eyes, round, hazel, and sad. Not angry. Not crazy. Anguished. Desperate. He wanted something, but it wasn't to shoot me. I'm Nichelle. I offered a smile and a hand. He nodded and let go of the stock of the gun, keeping his other fingers closed around the barrel. I didn't know what else to do. Taking a building full of sick people hostage is pretty far down my list of ways to spend a Wednesday night, I said, keeping my tone light. A ghost of a smile flashed on his unshaven face. Mine too. All evidence to the contrary. My nose picked up a hit of BO, my eyes skimmed the clothes again, and a puzzle piece clicked into place. Aaron said the guy knew the hospital. You don't work here, do you? He shook his head, his face crumpling. I can't lose her. They're going to let her die.
Headlines in high heels, indeed.
Wow.
That was excellent. Yeah, thank you, Lindy.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good stuff. So you have the next installment of Headlines in High Heels coming out next month, and that's Lethal Lifestyles, correct?
Yes.
And what would you like listeners to know about that novel as they can anticipate its release?
Oh, I had so much fun with this one. You know, it's funny, I don't ever really intend it, but somehow all of my mysteries end up with some kind of big central question. And for Lethal Lifestyles, it turned out to be, how well do we really know our closest friends? And so this mystery centers on the wedding of two of Nichelle's very best friends. And she has been asked to be their maid of honor and is determined to give them the perfect fairy tale. Except then a corpse crashes their rehearsal dinner, and unthinkably the next morning the groom is named suspect, and she cannot bring herself to believe that her friend is capable of such a thing, but no one will listen to her. So it's a race to see whether she's right about her friend or whether the evidence that's piling up against him is indeed correct.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds intriguing.
It was fun. It was really fun to write this book. For people who have read the earlier ones in the series, the wedding gave me an excuse to bring back secondary characters from a lot of the earlier books. And I love, when I read a series, to get to catch up with people from past novels. So it was just as much fun for me to write those scenes as I hope it will be for folks to read them.
Very nice. Marietta, were you gonna say something?
Oh, no. I just said it sounds excellent. I'm sucked in.
Oh, thank you.
And then, Linda, you've got a short story in an upcoming anthology as well, Midnight Mysteries, and that's coming up in September. So a couple of things coming out that month for you.
Yeah, we have Really Quick Together next month, and this was kind of fun because Midnight Mysteries is a collection. It's 9 Halloween-themed short stories. We have 9 best-selling mystery authors in that anthology, and it's a Nichelle story that comes in between Covershot and Lethal Lifestyles, so it'll be really fun, I hope, for my readers, because it'll get them back into the world and lead right into the new book that comes out like 12 days later.
Great. Yeah, that's a cool way to go about that. So where can people find out more about you and then keep up with everything that you have up and coming?
I spend most of my online time on Facebook. I'm at facebook.com/LindyWalkerBooks, and then I'm on Twitter @LindyWalker. I confess that I don't really understand Twitter as well as most other people seem to. Then I have a website too at LindyWalker.com.
LindyWalker.com. Yeah, I share your confusion about Twitter. I put things out there, and I have no idea if it goes anywhere, if anybody sees it. I think Faulkner had that famous quote that he's writing on the blank wall of oblivion the message that Kilroy was here. I think he was talking about Twitter when he said that.
Hell yeah.
That's pretty much it. My only claim to Twitter fame was my daughter was very excited last month when the Dixie Chicks retweeted our photo. We were at their concert, and I tweeted a picture of myself and my oldest daughter in the band retweeted it. She was very excited about that.
Oh,
yeah,
really
I was
cool.
At a concert recently, and they did a Snapchat live thing, and I thought, well, I'm just now getting into Instagram, and then there's this Twitter thing I don't know anything about. I'm not ready to take on another one just yet. But
you're one step ahead of me with Instagram. I have that one on my phone so I can monitor my daughter's account, but I don't have one there.
There you go.
I would call it the most fun new thing that I don't understand.
There we go. I like that.
Well, Lindy, thanks for being on, and thanks for sharing that story. And Lethal Lifestyles will be out September 27th, so everybody can just keep an eye out for that and pick that up. Sounds like that's going to be great. And next we have Sandra Rattan. Sandra is described as one of crime fiction's hot new voices, and she's had her first newspaper column at the age of 13. Studied journalism at 19, co-founded Spine Tingler Magazine in 2004, and burst onto the crime fiction scene with the debut of her first book, Suspicious Circumstances, in 2007. Rattan's books have been published in the United States, Canada, and have been translated into Japanese. Her other titles include What Burns Within, The Frailty of Flesh, and Lullaby for the Nameless. Sandra, welcome to Noir on the Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. So what are you reading for us tonight?
I have a flash fiction story called Life Without.
Life Without. Take it away.
Colleen couldn't imagine life without Daniel. Her brother was 11 months older, and the precocious Colleen soon became aware that, statistically, girls outlive boys. Most children cling to their mothers, the personal sun of their young lives revolve around, but for Colleen, the long absences and bitter battles that coincided with a prolonged divorce prompted her dependence on her brother. The childhood insecurities fostered by being part of a fractured family only amplified Colleen's concerns. Her mother had gone away, and she was afraid something would happen, and she might also have to find a way to live without Daniel. When Daniel was cornered by three boys after class and didn't meet her for the short walk home, Colleen searched the school inside and out until she found him. Seth McCormick shoved Daniel hard, and as he fell back, Colleen dove down and skinned her arms and legs to keep her brother's head from crashing onto the concrete. It was a move her father called misguided, although the doctor who examined the siblings after the incident said if the boys' bruises were any indication, Colleen's intervention likely prevented Daniel's skull from being split open. Later that night, Colleen crept into her brother's bedroom. "I don't want to lose you," she told him. "Don't be silly," he said. "Nothing's going to happen to me. I'm not going anywhere." "How do you know?" "I just do. Besides, I've got you to take care of me." She accepted that mission. Ever cautious, Colleen wiped up spills from the floor so that nobody would slip and insisted on Velcro to prevent anyone from tripping over their shoelaces. Daniel discovered that if you sat on cardboard at the top of the stairs, you could slide super fast to the bottom. He crashed into the TV stand, knocked down a tooth, and earned 3 stitches along his eyebrow. Colleen collected the cardboard, removed it all from the house, and insisted her father install non-slip stair treads. When Daniel learned how to pop a wheelie, he misjudged, spun the bike backwards, and cracked his helmet on the lawn gnome. Colleen bought her brother a better helmet after she saved enough allowance and sold the lawn gnome at the neighbor's yard sale. When she discovered her brother filled his lunch with processed cookies and cupcakes while forgoing the fruit their father diligently bought, Colleen assumed responsibility and packed Daniel's bag every night. Her happiness in fostering his healthy eating habits was hampered when she found him trading apples for fudge rounds. She threatened to punch his suppliers in the nose. 2 days later, she caught a girl named Tracy stealing her brother's apple from his bag. Colleen kicked her in the shins and made her put it back. Word got out that Daniel's lunches weren't to be tampered with, whether he was a willing participant or not. While Daniel's friends mocked Colleen's overprotectiveness, he knew that no matter what, his sister always had his back. With high school came hormones and the terror of teenage drama. Daniel was smart, sweet, and striking, the trifecta of benchmarks required by flirty girls already desperate to define themselves by who was willing to lock lips with them in the hallways between biology and health. Colleen faced her greatest challenge when she learned that Julia Hollis had her sights set on Daniel. The cheerleader knew how to flirt, frequently flaunted her assets for attention, and wasn't too proud to taunt the boys with how flexible she was, morally and otherwise. Obtaining images of Julia in compromising positions was as easy as the girl herself, but instead of showing her shinning up against the most popular boys in school, Colleen created a fake Facebook account and photoshopped the nerds from the chess club into the pictures, along with a partially redacted medical form confirming Julia had chlamydia. Daniel dated Diana instead. When her brother decided to apply for a job, Colleen destroyed a page of his application for the gas station, which was known for late-night robberies. Daniel was hired at Tina's sandwich shop instead. It was carry-on only. The lobby had room for no more than 4 people, and he did a small but steady business that had never attracted unwanted attention. Not until the night Daniel closed alone and someone he knew entered with a gun. Seth McCormick had started off bad and gotten worse. As he pointed the pistol at Daniel and demanded all the cash the register contained, Colleen arrived to walk her brother home. In the flash that it took to process what was happening, Colleen's instincts kicked in. Daniel yelled for her to look out while she shouted for him to duck as McCormick pivoted and pulled the trigger. The deafening blast of a gunshot reverberated through the small store, and in that split second, everything changed. Daniel couldn't imagine life without Colleen. The end.
Oh, wow. So good.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Yay.
I was I bet Colleen knows a thing or two about Twitter, but maybe not with an ending like that. Oh, my.
Wow. Yeah, probably not. Although if her brother had accounts, I'm sure she monitored them.
Yeah. Wow, that's hard hitting, but that's great. So, Sandra, I know from what I hear, you're very busy. As I understand it, you're a writer, editor, blogger. You help out the up and comers out there. How do you do all that and maintain your prolific writing pace?
You know, sometimes it's easier than others. I think in the last few years, I've learned a lot about balance. You know, I wasn't working at home. I was commuting for quite a while, and that really put a dent in my ability to write. And my kids were at a certain age that, you know, they required more attention. And so I'm kind of coming into a place now where I'm working at home, and I have a strict, you know, I have sort of a strict timeline policy and sort of balance down a certain amount of time for different things. So my philosophy is that when it comes to the writing time, 90% of your writing time should be spent writing 90% of that time. So, I really try to balance out not doing too many events unnecessarily or taking on more things than I'm capable of. But at the same point in time, it's wonderful to find different contacts and different people and new things to get excited about and to be able to do what you can to promote them. So I'm sort of working myself back into a place where I'm targeting doing a certain amount of material for Spine Tingler every month. But I maintain, you know, my husband and I have an official dinner and night apart night where that's my writing night. We eat dinner and then I go to work. He goes to do his work for Spine Tingler. So and then I'm on some weekends when I have more time, then I block out more time. But I have a whole, you know, I schedule out my work day, and then the time I used to spend commuting, that's when I work on my writing, and I work on different projects for different places.
It sounds focused and efficient.
Wow.
Yeah. How long does it take you to complete a manuscript?
If you don't stay focused, you lose it. Oh, so how long does it take me to complete a manuscript now? Or,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it really just depends. I had a manuscript done as of entering the summer, and somewhere around the middle of July, I decided to pretty much gut it and scrap down a considerable chunk of the manuscript. And started fresh, and I just finished it last weekend. So that's about, that was about 6 weeks, and very little of the original was retained. It just depends on, but, you know, sometimes you're right in the right place. I mean, I had that, I call it simmering. I had that that project in the back burner, on the back of the stove, and I kept thinking about it and kept kind of stirring it, and I really wasn't kind of coming up with the right ingredients to make myself happy with it. So I needed to wait until everything kind of clicked into place. And once I had that one thing that turned out was missing, everything just fell into place, and I was able to see what I wanted to do with it. So.
Yeah, moves pretty fast at that point. So, but effectively, you wrote two complete novels really in 6 weeks, it sounds like, with the amount of rework. So that's an amazing pace. Now, do you, with your experience with editing, do you edit as you go, or do you kind of get it all down and then save that for the end? What does that process look like for you?
I would say I'm in a constant editing process. process, because I've always had a tendency to write clean. I think that's instilled in you with a journalism background, because you're supposed to produce clean copy fast. So my motto is, if you're going to do it right the first time, you know. So, and you're still going, when you're writing a manuscript, you're still going to have typos that creep in there. And, you know, so what I tend to do is, you know, when I'm writing, is the next morning or the next time that I'm going back to it, I kind of reread through what I did the previous day. That kind of puts myself into that mental headspace of what was going on, make sure that everything is tightened up, or if there's anything that I need to add or adjust, that I do that. And that's when I'll catch errors at that point. And of course, I mean, at the end, you're still going to go over it and more than once. But I've been known to keep a notepad beside my bed and wake up in the middle of the night and scribble stuff that's absolutely illegible. But I've had a brainwave in the middle of the night about something in the manuscript or something I need to fix or something that I need to put in. And so I'm constantly doing things like that, you know, and sometimes I'll be, you know, out with the family and something will occur to me and I'll type myself a note on my phone and say, oh, you need to go in and add this, or you need to go in and change that, or you need to correct this mistake because you realize that you've made one. So for me, it's just always ongoing.
Yeah, no, I know the feeling. I have notes scattered depending on where I'm at, either on my phone, on a piece of paper somewhere, on my Kindle, or even on the voice recording app on the iPhone. If I'm driving, I'll mutter a few words to kind of capture an idea. But that's it's fun when it's really flowing like that, and you're just, you know, kind of immersed in it, and these ideas keep bubbling up. So what should people watch out for? Yeah. What should people watch for up and coming from Sandra Rutan?
Well, I have some short stories that I've been working on over the summer that that I'm just sending out there. So we'll see what happens with those. And I have a manuscript under consideration right now that would be for a new series. Potentially. So right now it's the waiting game. I'm waiting to see what's happening. And while I try to put those things out of my mind until I hear back, I'm going to be starting work on a sci-fi fantasy YA project. Awesome.
Very cool. Very cool. So we've got Spine Tingler, and where are the other best places to keep up with you?
I have a website, sandrarutan.com. We'll forward you to my website. And I am on Twitter, and I am on Instagram. And I confess I, you know, don't necessarily completely understand how all those things work either, but I do post there. I'm on Facebook, but I have to caution people that, you know, my first and foremost thing with Facebook was really to connect with my family, because I don't live close to my family, so I am a little cautious about accepting friend requests if I don't have a network that connects to a person. So if you're wanting to connect with me and we don't have friends in common, but you like my books or writing or what have you, and you want to connect that way, you can always send me a message and let me know so that I can accept you, because, it's for family first. My kids I'm connected to on there, and so I try not to overdo it on the book front. I guess maybe I should just have an author page, but I haven't gotten there yet. So.
Well, you have a full plate, it sounds like, already. So, but very cool, very cool. Thank you for coming on tonight, and thank you for that hard hitting story. That was great.
Thank you.
And next up, we have author Jen Makowski. Jen Makowski lives in Baltimore, Maryland. She was voted one of the best authors in Maryland by CBS News, one of 50 women to watch by the Baltimore Sun, and best writer by Baltimore Magazine. She's the author of the novels The Tide King, which was winner of the Big Moose Prize, The Summer She Was Underwater, which is forthcoming this month, and two collections of fiction, Close Encounters and From Here, and a collection of novellas, could be with her now. She also edited the anthology City Sages Baltimore, which Baltimore Magazine called Best of Baltimore in 2010. And she's the founding editor of the literary quarterly JMWW, hosts the monthly reading series Starts Here in Baltimore, and interviews writers at the Nervous Breakdown. Jen, welcome to tonight's show. It's great to have you.
Hi. Oh, it's great to be here, and I'm so happy to be sort of with these ladies again, virtually. So thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really pleased.
Well, you were all together recently at a Noir at the Bar event, weren't you?
Yes. It's great. It's called Noir at the Bar, and it's a great series. And I want to apologize to the ladies because I'm just going to be reading the same story. It's just, I'm sort of a wild card because I'm not particularly any genre. I guess with literary fiction, you can sort of be anything that you want, depending on which novel you're working on. So, you know, a lot of my books have had historical fiction in them, or murder, or there's love and romance, and there's science fiction, and there's also comedy. So I think that's the best part about being under that tent of sort of literary fiction, is you can really do whatever you want, but then at the same time, it's hard to market yourself because you're sort of everywhere. But then again, I get to to meet so many different writers, so I'm excited, and I hope that I'm going to read the first chapter from a novella called I Can Make It to California Before It's Time for Dinner, and it's just a few pages.
Sounds great.
I'll just go ahead and start.
Okay.
I watch the TV for my girlfriend Megan. She's 14 and I'm 15, and every day she's on that show that I watch about her. She's pretty and I wish we could hold hands and kiss. My brother Josh is 17 and doesn't play with me and doesn't like Megan. His girlfriend is not on TV and she's not pretty. Josh and his girlfriend call me retard and laugh. My name is Jimmy, but I laugh too. I'm watching Megan on TV, but Josh wants to watch TV too. He pushes me towards the door and then outside. He says, here's an idea. Why don't you go find her? Josh knows I'm only allowed to go to the 7-Eleven. He says maybe Megan lives somewhere between our house and the 7-Eleven. Maybe I will find her and kiss her. But the house Megan lives in on TV doesn't look like the house is on the way to the 7-Eleven. Then I remember when we go to the Giant that the houses between our house and the Giant don't look the same as the houses between our house and the 7-Eleven. And maybe those houses look like the house Megan lives in. But I'm not allowed to walk to the Giant. It's too far. I walk out of the yard. Mr. Pete, who drives the white truck, is on the sidewalk. He's putting his big toolbox in the back. Once in the summer, Mr. Pete gave me and Josh a ride to the skate park in the back of his truck. Josh tried to stand up on his skateboard while Mr. Pete was driving. He fell, and Mr. Pete had to take us to the hospital because Josh broke his arm. Josh sat inside the truck then, but I stayed in the back. The wind rushed into my mouth, and I couldn't close it. Mr. Pete, I asked, do you know where Megan lives? Can't say I do, Jimmy. He opens the door of his truck and gets in. Do you think she lives near the Giant? Not sure. Will you give me a ride to the Giant? Your mama know you're going? He looks at me. His clothes are all white like Mr. Clean, but he doesn't have a bald head, so he's not Mr. Clean's brother. You got a ride home? He asks again. Uh-huh. He coughs into his hand and spits on the ground, and he is thinking, I gotta go, Jimmy. I'm late for work. Besides, I don't need to take no more Dombrowskis to the hospital. I walk up the street. When we are in the car, it doesn't take long to get to the Giant. It is one song on the radio, maybe two. But Megan doesn't live at the Giant. Dad says, all the people on TV live in California. We live in Maryland. If I can make it to California before it's time for dinner, I should probably just go. I walk and sing, and I sing that Rihanna song four times, and then Justin Timberlake three times. My feet hurt, but I know I'm getting closer to California. The houses are bigger than the one I live in with Josh and my mom and dad. I wonder if they're bigger because more people live in them. There is one big brown and white house, and it looks like Megan's house on TV, but I can't remember exactly. I walk up to the door and knock, but nobody answers. I hear music coming from behind the house. Behind the house is a deck. A girl is lying down in her bathing suit. She has brown hair like Megan and a body like Megan, but Megan doesn't wear a bathing suit on TV. But it is her house, so I think it must be her. Hi, Megan. I stand on the deck. The grass is growing over my sneakers, and I smell dog poop. Who are you? She sits up. I can't see her eyes because she's wearing sunglasses. I'm Jimmy Dombrowski, and I live on 890 Dunkirk, and I watch you on TV. My name's not Megan, she says. I walk up the steps so I can see her better. Stop right there, she holds her hand. You have to leave. I watch you on TV every day, and you're pretty, and I want to be your boyfriend. Do I look like I'm on TV? She takes a sip of her soda. But people on TV are just like you and me, I say to her. Can I have a soda? Everything in TV is make-believe, she answers, lighting a cigarette. Megan doesn't smoke. And no, you may not have a drink. You need to leave. She stands and turns toward the house. There are glass doors, and I can see myself behind her. I'm going to tell you one more time to get out of here, and then I'm going to call the police. I'm on the deck now. I want to hug her goodbye. She pushes at me. Get away, you retard, she screams, and I put my hand on her mouth. Megan bites my hand. I push her away. She is smaller than me and falls against the glass door. I feel bad and put my arms around her to pick her up. We are up half the way. She hits me in the chest and face. I get mad like I get when Josh hits me and leaves marks. She hits me in the face again, and it hurts bad. I put my hands on her neck and twist real hard back and forth. She puts her hands on my hands, but I am bigger. Her face turns all red, and it's kind of funny how red. She keeps moving and kicking, and I try to stop her. We are up half the way when she falls asleep on me. She is so heavy, I let her fall, and then I wait for her to stop make-believing, because people on TV are always doing make-believe, the way that Josh pretends to sleep until I go away. But she still make-believes her sleep. It is getting dark. It is time for dinner, and I will get in trouble. I kiss Megan on the lips. I tell her I will see her tomorrow. At home, I will tell Josh I found Megan out in California, that I kissed her, and that she does make-believe better than he does. And that's the end of the first chapter.
Amazing.
Good stuff. What did you say the name of that novella was again, Jen?
It's called I Can Make It to California Before It's Time for Dinner.
I'd say there are several of us who want to read the rest of that. So just making a note there. All right. Very good. So where is the best place for people to keep up with you out there on the web, Jen?
Well, I have a website, jenmikowski.com, and I do stuff on – I am on Twitter. Like you, I'm not sure what exactly that is, but I do try to keep current, and I'm happy to retweet anything that anyone sends my way. And – yeah, I'm on Facebook. I have a reading series here in Baltimore, so I'm always happy to book authors and I meet them that way, and I interview people, like you said, on the Nervous Breakdown. So it sort of keeps me busy, just always being inspired by other writers and different disciplines. And we have a good noir community here in Baltimore. Yeah, of course, Laura Lippman's here, and I guess that's sort of how I got to know the DC scene a little bit too, was through some connections in Baltimore here.
Yes, okay. Very cool. And what's new and upcoming that we should watch for?
Well, I had a novel that just dropped a few weeks ago. It's called The Summer She Was Underwater. And so I'm just sort of starting to do the book tour now and doing readings. I'm going to be in Virginia and D.C. a bunch of times next month, and then Philly and New York, and then hopefully wrap it up before the end of the year. So it's always a little hectic after you spend so much time writing it. You feel like you've already run the marathon, but then you have to run another one, you know, after that to promote it. So I'm just trying to catch my breath before I start doing the tour. But I'm excited and looking forward to it.
Very exciting. Well, thank you for being on the show tonight. Next up, we have an excellent writer who's no stranger to Nora on the radio. She's the person who arranged and set up everything you've heard tonight, and she's organizing an upcoming Nora at the Bar event that you don't want to miss, and she's none other than the one and only Marietta Miles. Marietta Miles has published stories with Thrills, Kills, and Chaos, Flash Fiction Offensive, Yellow Mama, Revolt Daily, and more. And she has stories and anthologies offered through Static Movement Publishing, Horrified Press, and soon Gutter Books. Her first novel, Route 12, is now available through All Due Respect Books. Born in Alabama, raised in Louisiana, she currently resides in Virginia with her husband and two children. And you can visit www.mariettamiles.blogspot.com or Facebook for more stories and further information. Hello, Marietta.
Hello. How are you?
How are you? I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me back on.
Well, thanks for coming back on, and thanks for all of your help getting everything organized and set up for us tonight with a wonderful group of writers. What do you have to share with us tonight?
Well, this is actually from Route 12, and it is the second novella in that collection. It's called Blood and Sin, and this is the introduction to the character called by the name of Pastor Friend. Her name was Holly. She had come to his house one Sunday after church. Daniel's sermon had been a touchy one, difficult for most to take. He lectured in silky tones, speaking of avoidance, temperance, and sin. Scriptures and songs slipped from his sweet mouth. He had known even then what he did to the girls in church, how they watched him. Caught under their dreamy attention, he was at first excited, wanting, but soon he began to hate them, seeing the girls, the followers, as pitiful and dirty. That evening, he and Holly had relaxed on the front porch drinking tea brewed in the sun just that afternoon. Daniel had seen her at church often. She volunteered once a month in the nursery, her baby brother, one of her charges. And every other Sunday, she and her parents sat in the second pew. He asked if she wished to go for a walk. They stepped closely together, rounding the house, heading for the backyard and a path through the woods. Along the way, they brushed against blooming mulberry trees and passed behind a big oak just under the edge of the woods. His warm hand brushed her bare arm. "I'm glad you came out tonight," he said. "Me too," she answered, watching her step. He stared at her, eager, anticipating. When he grabbed her arm, she fell to the side, confused and startled by his change. Dazed, she lifted her chin, thinking he wanted to kiss her. For a moment, she was charmed. His left hand, wide and open, came across her cheek, smashing against her ear, leaving it ringing. The fine, rounded bone under her eye cracked and her head twisted to the side. Her breath hitched in her throat, but before she could cry, he crushed her mouth with his hand and pushed her to the ground behind the tree. Daniel covered her with his full weight, pinned her head to the ground, both hands over her mouth, pushing down hard. He pushed himself up, putting a knee on each of her small hands. He balled up his right fist and punched her soft belly. She screamed behind his hand. Her legs kicked and thrashed. "Shut up, just shut up." He looked down on her, shaking her head with his angry hand. He cocked his head. "This is what you get," he said. Porch light threw a spotlight across the yard, and the back door clattered open. "Daniel?" His mother trudged from the house, pushing toward the old oak tree. She could see a commotion in the dirt. "What is that girl doing here? Get out of here, you!" she hollered, getting closer. "Just look at you," Daniel whispered, spitting with disgust, rolling off Holly. She remained perfectly still on the ground, sucking in air, desperate to breathe. Daniel reached under her wrinkled, dusty shirt, pinching her and scraping his nails across her skin, leaving small, bloody marks. "Mother, it's okay. She was just leaving." she said. What kind of girl comes to a boy's house alone? She said. Don't worry, Mother. She couldn't trick me. Let's go. I want to go in now. Don't think I won't call your mother. I will. I swear I will. The girl sat behind the tree, shaking and suffering until the stars came out. When she was able to sneak up to her own house, she heard her mother through the kitchen window talking on the phone. I'm sure I don't know what has gotten into the girl, Esther, her mother chattered. Holly sat under the porch until her folks went to bed. Her head hurt, her chest and ribs hurt. When Holly's mother came for her in the morning, tired and angry from the long, worrisome night, she didn't find her daughter in bed. She didn't find Holly in the house at all. She found her girl in the shed, lying in the deep soaking tub off to the right of the washer and dryer. The water in the basin was a swirly cloud of red and pink. Holly's eyes were open. Now, sitting at its teak desk, a generous gift from a grateful parishioner, Pastor Friend wonders to himself if all women are made of nothing but blood and sin. And that's it.
Hmm. Wow, yeah, that's Pastor Friend. Wow. He's a swell guy, right?
He's such a what a fellow, let me tell you.
Well, thank you, Marietta. Indeed, that's only the beginning, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that with us tonight.
Thank you.
So, yeah, tell us about this event you have that you're planning for Richmond. I was talking about Roanoke earlier, but it's actually in Richmond.
Yeah, that's several hours away. That would have been really awful for us to get to you.
Yeah, different sides of the state, right?
Well, on November 5th, we are going to do Richmond's very first Noir at the Bar, and it's from 5 to 7 at this really great little pub called McCormick's down in the Shaco Bottom. And actually, all of the ladies that are on with us, except for Miss Jen, will be joining us there, and Mr. Greg Barth will be joining us there. So we have a really long list of excellent writers, and I'm just so excited about it all.
We're excited.
So, for those who might not be familiar with what Noir at the Bar is, let everyone know what they can expect.
Well, Noir at the Bar is, and they do this in cities all around the country. So if anybody gets a chance to go, they really should do it. But what it is some of the best Noir writers come together and they do sort of a flash fiction throwdown almost, where they take their best flash pieces and read it, and you get to drink and listen and drink, and it's awesome.
It's a lot of fun.
It's going to be air conditioned, or at least it's going to be November.
Oh yes, November, and much less will look so great, ladies. We really will.
Without a doubt.
Well, looking forward to it for sure, and getting to meet everyone in person.
Yes.
And that, you know, kind of brings me to my Greg Barth news I was mentioning early on. I should have a new novel out in time to share at the bar. I'm not really the one to announce a release date or anything, but I've heard October the 1st. The book is called Rogue Carnage. And I'd like to share a selection from that at Noir at the Bar. Even though my brother has cautioned me against reading any of that publicly, it's going to be a lot of fun. So looking forward to getting that out and sharing some
awesome
of it at the bar. I think that. Well, thank you. And folks, that's a wrap. Dames in the Dark. Thank you to Sean Riley Simmons, Lindy Walker, Sandra Rattan, Jen Mikowski, and Marietta Miles. And thanks for all of our listeners joining us for Dames in the Dark. Check out the books from these excellent writers that you've heard some excerpts from tonight. You won't be disappointed. And until next time, this is Greg Barth.